This episode is brought to you by Home Team Inspection Service. When you partner with Home Team, you're getting more than a home inspection. You're delivering the home team experience. With a team approach, fast turnarounds, and package options that include home inspection warranties, Home Team helps real estate pros stand out. Plus, many locations now offer pay at close, giving your clients flexibility when they need it most. Schedule your next inspection with confidence at hometeam.com.
I was like, you know, working hard, playing football, like, you know, in class. And he used to give me extra work assignments. I was like, man, what are you doing? I'm like, you see how hard I'm working. And he would always say stuff to me. It's like, he's like, you as a black man in America have to work harder than your peers.
Welcome to the Color Money Podcast. I am Bo Mikiti, and today I am not joined by my amazing co-hosts, Julia Lachey, Imrich Peace, and Daniel Dixon, but we are in for a very special treat because we have Jamar Adams with us today, and I'm really excited about this conversation. Jamar is someone that I have a tremendous amount of respect for, that I've admired for a long time and had the opportunity to work with in a couple of instances. And I'm looking forward to really digging in to his story and how that impacts our conversation about development, about wealth, about legacy. So you're in for a treat. So Jamar Adams is the founder and managing principal of Essence Development, which is a 100% minority-owned real estate investment development firm that's focused on creating high-quality, socially impactful, and sustainable communities. Jamar founded this firm in 2020 and is dedicated to delivering affordable and workforce housing, mixed-use developments, and community-centered infrastructure that integrates health and nutrition, nonprofit partnerships, workforce development opportunities into the built environment and real estate development projects. He built his firm based on the principle that equitable housing and holistic community investment are essential drivers of meaningful and lasting change in our neighborhoods. He's done a bunch of amazing things in his life, and we're going to talk a little bit about that, about how you achieve excellence at so many different levels. You know, prior to being in real estate, Jamar played in the NFL with the Seattle Seahawks and the Philadelphia Eagles, graduated from Michigan University, and Essence Development. He then worked at related companies. Essence Development currently has a portfolio that includes over $6 billion in development that encompasses over 3,800 affordable and workforce housing units, 3,000 market rate units, and nearly 500,000 square feet of life science and research space across the Northeast. So Jamar, welcome. Thank you for being with us. I'm really excited for the conversation today.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here and glad to be able to spend some time with someone I very much so respect what you've done professionally as well as personally on this journey.
Well, great. So maybe let's just start off, like, let's jump right into it. Tell us a little bit about your story. I think it will help our listeners a lot to sort of get a sense of the fabric of your story, maybe starting with where you grew up and sort of that journey all the way through to New York and related and now your own firm.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the journey is interesting from this perspective. So I grew up in a single parent household in Charlotte, North Carolina. My mom raised me and my two older brothers. My older brothers are 5 and 10 years older than me. For me, I was involved in a whole bunch of things, jazz band, city choir. I was kind of a Renaissance kid, but obviously I was involved in sports as well. But one of the things I was involved in was very young that I ended up going to the Nationals and winning the state of North Carolina was chess. And that's kind of actually informed a lot of things in my life, you know, thus far. I'm kind of a strategic thinker in all the things that I do. But from kind of high school, I ended up excelling in football. I played basketball, I ran track, but I excelled at a high level in football. Ended up getting to go to University of Michigan on a scholarship. Played there for 4 years, was a two-time All Big Ten player. Got blessed to go and play in the NFL. As you said, with the Seahawks and the Eagles. And while I was playing in the NFL, interestingly enough, I look back to a story I had at the University of Michigan where there was a black professor, Professor Onye, who used to challenge me. I was taking 18 hours courses. I was like, you know, working hard, playing football, like, you know, in class. And he used to give me extra work assignments. I was like, man, what are you doing? I'm like, you see how hard I'm working. And he would always say stuff to me. It's like, he's like, you as a black man in America have to work harder than your peers. Just because you're here in Michigan and just because you have the same degree as them doesn't mean you'll get to like operate like they operate. You'll have to operate at a higher frequency. And so he would do other small things like make me take my scully off in class or make me take my hoodie off in class when other people were sitting there with hoodies. And he was like, you can't operate like other people. Just because you're in the same space, you can't have the same outcomes or results as them. It has to be better. So one of the assignments he had me do is I had to read current affairs every week and then write him a paper on it. And about the third week, this is in 2006, I read in the New York Times, Blackstone had gone public and Steven Schwarzman had collected a bonus of $1.2 billion. And from a kid who grew up in, you know, a single parent household in Charlotte, North Carolina, that grew up in public housing, then affordable housing, my mom bought a house for $49,000, to then hear someone made $1 billion as a bonus. Like, and I didn't really understand how the concept worked. I thought like your bonus was always like, you know, percentage of what you made. So I was like, if he had $1 billion bonus, he must have made like $2 billion in salary. I didn't really get it then. But like, it really started to push me to say, well, what is this finance thing? And like, how do people make money? And so then the crisis happened in 2007 and 2008. I'm in the NFL now. I actually have a little money. I have people coming to me saying, hey, let me invest your money. And I was responding to them because I had been reading all these books. Once my interest had got sparked to finance, and I was reading all these books and had all these questions for them. So I would say, listen, I'll talk to you about it, but you got to explain these things that I'm reading in these books. You got to explain these things that I'm like doing some research on. And that ended up leading them to saying, man, you have a great inquisitive nature about you. Why don't you come on and job shadow with us for a while? And then that led to saying, man, you're pretty intelligent. Why don't you come and intern with us in the summer if you have time? And I got to intern at some amazing investment banks. People were amazing to me. I think it's easy when you go into someone's office. I would go in their offices on Tuesdays during the season. They would just have seen me play on either Sunday or Monday. And so like everyone wants to talk to you. I'd give them 20 minutes of like, oh man, when that guy hit me, it was so hard. My neck was hurting. And like, oh, Tom Brady's amazing or Peyton Manning's amazing. But the rest of the day, I'd have their undivided attention. And I would get to go and meet the most senior people in the company because they're like, hey, guess who's here? And so that access was tremendous for me, which then again led me to saying, once I got injured, I said, I'm going to go work at Goldman Sachs, you know, interview, got the job offer. You know, when I think back, it's pretty amazing from football right into Goldman. And then before starting at Goldman, I had met with Stephen Ross at the related companies trying to get a letter of recommendation, go to business school. Because I said,
so anyway, time out. I got to stop. It's like, for those who may not know who Stephen Ross is, like, he's just like throws it out like, oh, I was going to get a recommendation from Stephen Ross to go to business school. That's not a normal person's type of thing. So you might put some context around that, Jamal.
So the context of that is that Stephen Ross went to the University of Michigan. So one, who is he? He owns the Miami Dolphins. He went to the University of Michigan, and University of Michigan Business School, after he made a $125 million donation, was named after him. And so he is a large philanthropist to the University of Michigan and has the largest real estate development company in North America. And so, you know, I was in a golf tournament. I was preparing to go and start at Goldman Sachs. And I met a guy and I was telling him my story. I was like, yeah, I'm going to go work at Goldman. He's like, are you done with football? I said, yeah. But my goal is I want to go to business school. And I went to Michigan undergrad. I want to go to Michigan business school because, like, I read Stephen Schwarzman went to business school. So if I want to turn into Stephen Schwarzman one day, I got to go to business school. Like, that's the formula. And, you know, I went to Michigan undergrad. I want to go to Michigan business school. It's a pretty good business school. And he said, hey, I think I know a guy here at the event, University of Michigan golf event, that knows Stephen Ross. I got connected with the guy. The guy met with me, called me 2 days later and said, I got a meeting for you and Stephen. He said, he wants you to fly up to New York. I had a 15-minute slot of time to meet with him. I was wearing like all my stuff was being shipped from Detroit while I was rehabbing my neck to Chicago, where I was working in Chicago office of Goldman. And so I didn't have any like dress clothes. And Steven's a very formal guy, suit, coat and tie. And so I had on some Vans, some like jeans that were kind of like professional. I had a shirt. The jeans were too big, so I had them folded up in the back. So I meet the guy I'm supposed to, you know, taking me to meet Steven. He's 300 pounds. And he's like, you can't meet Steven without a jacket. So he gives me his jacket. So I'm like swimming in his jacket. I'm like all disheveled walking into the meeting. But I think in that moment that like sometimes you have like divine providence. And I had divine providence. I was supposed to be at that meeting. It didn't matter what I was wearing. It didn't matter anything. I was supposed to be there and I was supposed to make the connection. So he said to me, after like 10 minutes of me talking about like, you know, Stephen Schwarzman and wanting to go and start Goldman to then go end up in a private equity business to start my own private equity company. He says, you should work for me. I think you'd be a superstar here. And, you know, after a couple of days of like me kind of being like, I don't really know. You know, he was calling me, which is also amazing. Like this guy who's like this, you know, amazing titan in the industry is calling me like, hey, I think you should really come work for me. Like, I know you left, but like, trust me, that is going to be the best decision you'll make. One of his classic lines is we're in a meeting. And I said, I've given my commitment to Goldman to start. I'm supposed to start in a week. So he had his phone in his top pocket. He pulled it out. He says, I'll call Lloyd Blankfein right now and tell him, screw you, he's coming to work for me. I jokingly said back to him, I was like, I'm pretty sure Lloyd Blankfein doesn't know me. But when I said it, I realized the proximity to, you know, influence was so important. That's what, that was one of the things to me. I was like, yeah, that's right. The CEO of that company wouldn't know me. But the guy who's the CEO of this company and the founder would know me. So I think that probably would do me better in growth and opportunities. And so, yeah, started related 2012, worked in the affordable housing division. We bought project-based Section 8. We bought tax credit deals. We preserved them. We renovated them. Then I went back to Stephen and said, hey, I want the guy to go back to business school. I don't want any kind of glass ceilings. He said, you don't need to go to business school. But if you do, I'll pay for it. But you got to go to Columbia, NYU. I want you to keep working here. And so he said, but I want to start moving you around the company. And I want you to understand how this entire company works because I know you say you want to start your own company. So I did a little bit of stuff for management business, related fund management, and then went to New York Development, which is their ground up construction kind of pipeline or vertical. Because of my affordable housing experience, I built some affordable stuff, built supportive housing, mixed income. But because they also do market rate, I did market rate development, condo components, and then large some mixed use projects. So that's where I kind of, I mean, related was the place where it really shaped my professional development, like really understanding what real estate development was, really understanding what financing of these projects are, and thinking about how to, you know, weave all these projects from a business construction, urban fabric kind of component together.
I want to go back to one thing, because I think it's really interesting. Like, a lot of times we've had conversations about how we don't see ourselves in other opportunities. And one of the things that's so amazing about your story and about you is you read this article about Steve Schwarzman. A lot of people would have said, well, I'm not like him. He's not like me. He doesn't look like me. He didn't come from where I came from. And they would have not seen that as a role model. But you read an article about somebody. You set your sights to say, well, I could do that. What is it about your mindset or your thinking that was able to take that, you know, piece of research, encouraged by the person who was pushing you, the professor who was pushing you to think more, and say, well, that could be me. There's no reason that couldn't be me.
Yeah.
Like, why not?
Well, I mean, look, I had a great mother. There was nothing I ever looked at. Like, I talked about a little bit of my childhood was, like, I was in this thing called Odyssey of the Mind, which is like this like kind of creative think outside the box thing. And I was a chess champion growing up. I played in the city jazz band. I was in the city choir. You know, I was an athlete, football, basketball, track. Like, I did all these things. And what I realized during the experience when I was young was, if you commit yourself to something, you will get results out of it. It may not be exactly what you want, but you will get positive results from it. And so I had nothing else in my life that said to me that, like, if I saw something that I wanted to do, that I couldn't do it. Because mind you, at that point in time, I'm in college playing at one of the most historic universities in the country, you know, major college football. Like, I think that year I was like a semifinalist, which means you're the top nine people in the country as a defensive back. I was a semifinalist for the Thorpe Award. And mind you, I would always, from when I was a kid, I would always look at people and say, that's my example. And then try to research them to say, well, what did they do to get to where they were? And I'd be like, okay, I got to do that. So, you know, when I was a kid, I loved Jerry Rice. When I was a kid, I loved Barry Sanders. When I was a kid, I loved Ricky Williams. When I was a kid, I loved Charles Woodson. And now I'm at the University of Michigan, you know, and like Charles Woodson comes to campus like, you know, Adams, you doing well, man. Like, and so I'm like, what I realized is that for me, it was identify someone that I said, I want to emulate them in this component. Maybe it was a professional component. Maybe it was a philanthropic component. Maybe it was a spiritual component. But I want to emulate you. But in emulating you, I needed to understand your background. Well, what did you do to get there? Mm. Again, what I start to realize is if I understood what you did, it's just a formula. I started getting to a point and I saw this interview that Barack Obama had said, I think it's like something that so many people should hear and see. He said, when I was a state senator, I thought that like, man, I'm being a state senate. Like, I'm going to be like one of the, he's like, I realized there's like a couple people who are super talented and amazing. couple people that's like kind of dumb, and then a whole bunch of average people. So then I became a U.S. senator. He's like, man, I'm the U.S. Senate. It's only 100 plus of us, man. Yeah, I might be. He's like, I realize there's a couple people that's really talented, a couple people, right? And, and then he said, that elevated all the way to the point. He's like, now I'm the president of the United States. I'm going to the G7 summit. Where's the seven, like, leaders of the seven biggest economies in the world? And the same thing, there's a couple of them real smart. And so I kept having those same experiences, couldn't articulate it the same way. But I would go places and I'm like, I'm here at the state championship in chess. And I'm thinking, I'm this like black kid. And like, I got this coach and I got this like tutor. But like these kids, like, been doing it since they were young kids. And I'm winning games. And I'm like, hold on. Like, if I dedicate myself to something, focus, intentional, like, I will have results. Again, I may not always win the championship. I may not always be number one. But it's going to put me in a space where I'm extremely competitive. And so, same thing will happen with Schwartzman. I saw his story. Where did he go to undergrad? Where did he go to business school? Where did he work? And then the real thing that really gave me a whole bunch of confidence, interestingly enough, he said he and Pete Peterson started a company with like $400,000. I was like, man, I'm about to go to the NFL. I should have that type of money when I leave the NFL. So like, there should be nothing there that should keep me from having opportunities that he had. And maybe I won't turn into Steven Schwartzman, like, you know, like run the biggest asset manager in the world. But like, if I own my own private equity firm and like, you know, I'm there, I'm on a great path.
Somebody told me the other day, it was one of the most powerful things someone said to me. They said, here's my board of advisors, some like really bigwigs. And I was like, oh, really? They're on your board of advisors? Like, yeah, they're on my virtual board of advisors. I study them. They don't meet with me. I've never met them, but I study them. I understand what their principles and what their lives are like, and I apply those things in my life. And so I think, Jamar, your story talks about the mindset your mother put in you, that you could do multiple things. You didn't go to the NFL saying, I'm just a football player. You went having done, I have excelled in chess. I've excelled in music. I've done these different things. I know that there are models I can follow. There are people I can emulate, regardless of who's in my family or where I am or what's going on. You know, for lots of people that have different situations, you can go find people. They don't have to look like you. They don't have to be like you, but you can learn principles from their story and from the systems that made them. And those models can be impactful in your life. And I think that's just a powerful part of what you've done in your life and how that's been there. So I want to shift gears a little bit. I want to talk about starting Essence. And then I want to come back to some of the emotional elements of this piece. Let's tactically talk a little about what encouraged you to start Essence and how did that go? So you're in this big firm, you're talking to the chairman, he's helping you develop. What caused you to go out and start your own firm?
So I'll start by saying this. Starting Essence is the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. Running Essence is the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. I think I've done some interesting things, but hardest thing by far. Why did I do it? So again, remember I talked about when I was telling Steven at first, like, what my goals were. And I told him, I said, look, I want to go to Goldman, go to business school, go work at a private equity firm, start my own private equity firm. So my original conversation was about, I want to start my own business. And he always knew that. He would say to me all the time, he said, I'm going to teach you real estate. I want you to teach me football. So I would end up, I had these absolute amazing experiences where I would go to about 90% of the Dolphin football games with him. Like, we would sometimes go to a Michigan game and then we'd go to the Dolphins game. On those flights, sometimes it'd be other people, like Warren Buffett or like, you know, all these amazing people. And sometimes it'd just be he and I, right? And we're like stuck in this tube. And it's like, we're flying there for 3 hours. I just have 3 hours and he want to sit in front of me and talk to me. Hey, how's everything going? What you working on? Right? And then he would start giving me nuggets about like, so when you start your business, like, he would talk to me as though like, I was 100% going to do it, right? And like, it's so amazing to me that he did that. But he would talk to me like I was, he'd be like, so when you start your business and you start making money, you got to remember, you got to put all the money back into the company, right? Don't live extravagant. A lot of guys, they struggle because they make a little money and they want to go and live this big life and they want to drive a fancy car. You don't need no fancy car. You don't need, just keep pumping it back into the business. Like, he'd give me these nuggets. And so when I got to a time, what happened was I had gone to them and I had put together a presentation about me starting what I was going to call Related Workforce Housing, which at the time Related had what they call New York Development, which is like a group that builds all the new construction, but primarily focused on like market rate and luxury stuff. They do affordable housing, but that's their focus is luxury and condos. And I say, look, we need a group that will represent a business that's focused on building affordable housing, building workforce housing, you know, focused on that, right? And I went to them, I said, here's the proposal. And they were like, this sounds good. Let's start talking about numbers. And then COVID happened. So things slow down. And then George Floyd happens. And so I'm like close to them, close to the executive team. They're reaching out to me. We're talking about like strategically what we should be thinking about within the company of how we should be addressing things. We put together a diversity committee. We're meeting frequently, talking about the things we're going to do to create retention and all those things within the company. In the moment in time, I'm sitting there thinking, I'm talking about starting a group here related, but I think there's an opportunity for me to leave right now and start my own thing, right? And I'll tell you, there's a guy who, it's probably maybe the first time I say this publicly. There's a guy who worked at Related and used to work at Goldman Sachs. And he called me every single day and say, like, this is a moment in time where people of color are going to have access and get opportunity. What are you going to do about it? He'd be like, you got to get something out this moment. He's like, you got to focus and get some. I'm talking about he called me every single day. Like, what'd you do? What'd you do? And so I'm now tracking with either friends and myself, all of the dollars that are being allocated by banks and other institutions to like, you know, minority businesses and minority causes. So then I start processing. I said, man, I'm talking about starting a group here related. And like, I'm looking and I'm saying we do partnerships with like minority owned firms or not-for-profits on like RFP deals. And these people, like the businesses are getting more than I get as a related employee. And I'm running the deal. Like I'm running, I know every aspect of this deal and they're getting more economics than me. I was like, why wouldn't I just start my own business and then potentially partner with related or other groups and like get that or more, right? And there could be a business opportunity there. And I kept pounding that thought. I said, well, there's a lot of dollars going out right now for people of color and businesses. That may be opportunity. I said, I think maybe these RFPs will then have more and higher requirements for minority participation. That's an opportunity. And then I really started to have, thinking back my time at Related. I had been doing a lot of work on, you know, seeing, you know, trying to grow diversity with women and people of color and all these systems and things that we're trying to put together to see that happen. And I realized if you're not the decision maker, right, you can't change it. You can create some impact, but you can't change these things. And I realized to start my own investment and development firm, I'd have the ability to have real impact. I'd have the ability to make the decisions on who the architect was going to be. I'd have the ability on consultants and general contractors. I'd have the ability to say, not I strongly recommend we hire this person, but say, I'm going to hire this person, right? So I would have the ability to create the diversity in the industry that I know needs to be there. Because also what I would see is, you know, they act across the industry. I'm not making it focus on any business. Across the industry, you know, if you think about, I'll give New York City public housing an example. 90% of New York City public housing is occupied by minorities and people of color. 90%. Okay. When you look at the overwhelming majority of developers that actually do the development that's redeveloping public housing in New York City, they're the reverse. They're overwhelmingly majority non-minority groups. And I'm like, that doesn't make sense because to me, I have the ability, and this is in this case, and it's applicable in other ways. I have the ability to bring an empathy to the situation because one, I grew up in public housing. I have family members who still live in Section 8 housing. And I have two cousins that just happily got Habitat for Humanity to build them a home, right? Like I have an ability to have empathy and therefore then deliver a process that will then deliver a product that is better than people who may not be able to bring that sort of level of empathy, right? And so all those things kind of came together and I said, I have to do this business, right? It became an imperative for me. And I went to Steven and said, you know, Steven, I know we were talking about this, but like, and I went to Bruce Beal, said, I know we're talking about me, but I think I should start my own business. And they both looked at me and said, you're 100% right. You should leave and start your own business. And the first thing, piece of advice Steven told me at that moment, he said, first thing you need to do is hire somebody. So when people call you, you don't answer the phone. So they make your company sound like it's bigger. Oh, the second piece of advice he gave me that moment, he says, don't call a company like Adams Development. This is his advice. You want it to be something that's not based and rooted in you because you don't want people to come and think they're like working for you. they're working with the vision that you set. It's not about Jamar. It's about the vision, the collaborative vision that we all are aiming for, right? Like what Essence is trying to do, that's my vision, but we all are aiming at the same vision. Like, and so I've definitely tried to focus on that component, which is, you know, I do believe people come and join a team because they believe in me and the vision. I think it's far more about the vision and our ability to obtain and achieve that vision than about me.
Home Team Inspection Service is changing the way agents and clients experience home inspections. Their team-based model, streamlined scheduling, and bundled packages, including home inspection warranties, make the process smoother from contract to closing. And with Pay at Close available in many locations, you can give your buyers more peace of mind with less upfront cost. Choose the team that works with yours. Visit HomeTeam.com to learn more.
So can you share with me a little bit about the principles of Essence? You just talked about, you know, this bigger vision. I can relate to that too, because I think I got one of those things right, and then I got stuck with the other one because that brokerage business stuck in my name. And I've been wishing for the last 10 years, maybe the first 10 years, I didn't care. For the last 10 years, I've been wishing my company was named something else because this idea of a bigger vision. So talk to me about what is that vision? What are the principles of Essence? And what's enabled it to grow so quickly? I mean, we talked about some big, big numbers, but I also like to break it down to like the small steps, because whether you're going to be like Jamar and own 3,000 units or you're going to own 3 rental doors, the process is very much the same and the mindset is the same. And so can you tell us a little bit about what were the principles that built Essence, that bigger vision that you want people to be attracted to? And then how did you make it so successful so fast?
I think our purpose is to create communities of opportunity, right? That's a big, broad purpose. I think we can attain that. And it happens in a whole bunch of different ways, but that's our purpose, to create communities of opportunity. Like what I want ultimately at the end of the day is everything we touch is to give opportunities to more new people, to do it in the highest qualities of ways, in the most empathetic ways. Talking about our values, you know, care, passion, teamwork. Like we use those, and we have 6 values, but when you use those as names for our actually meeting rooms in our office, because I want that to be ingrained in our team. What is our values? Like, what do we stand for here? How we get there, right? Is to me, it's this, I think the ultimate vision is this. Let's focus just on real estate. We're looking at construction and other aspects, but focus on real estate. The vision is this: as a development firm, we have a tremendous amount of information on our residents. We can see the need in a lot of our communities as well. So let's go to like a project-based Section 8 community. And the best thing too is that's a dynamic of the empathy that could be brought to the table. I have a 71-year-old mother. I'm praying that these are not facts, but like she is showing signs of dementia. And so like me and my brothers are having to do a lot of work to help her in like not day-to-day life, but like week-to-week life, right? So well, we have a whole bunch of senior project-based Section 8 housing, right? I actually know because I've had to help my 71-year-old mother actually get all the right Medicare like parts signed up for. I know how hard it is. Like I'm an educated guy and I struggle to get through these things. And so I know these residents who don't have as much resources that I have and maybe don't have kids that have retirement my mom has, like they will struggle with those things. So programmatically, we're setting up programs that will help those seniors sign up for the programs in their community, at the state level, and at the federal level, so that they are able to grasp the resources that have already been provided to them, but takes some kind of administrative skill to get to them and access them, right?
I want to just put a pin on that, because you said earlier, it's empathy and perspective that come from your experience that drive process, which creates products and systems that drive impact. And I think at the heart of it, that's the value of diversity. Like it's not some catchword, it's not something, it's actually value creation through different experiences being implemented into a process, which prior to that did not include those experiences or those perspectives, thereby yielding a better process and a better product, which delivers a better outcome. And I think that the way you frame that is really powerful for us, especially in this moment when there's all this conversation about diversity as if it's this abstract thing that goody two-shoes people. No, no, we're talking about how multiple perspectives that have not been included in a process improve the product and change people's lives. So I just
absolutely
think it's powerful.
You know, to expand on that diversity piece, like, you know, we have women in our firm, you know, we're really looking to hire a senior woman on the development side. We have a lot of women on our development team. We want to hire a senior, like the most senior person on the development side. I want it to be a woman. Why? Because I've sat and spent time speaking to women in the development space and I've heard their challenges. And like, there's aspects of it that I just can't grasp. I don't know what the concerns are with dealing with, I will never be out of work for 6 months, God willing, right? But if you're of a certain age as a woman, you may have 3-4 times that you're going to be out of work for potentially up to 6 months because something that's an absolute amazing gift to you and your family and the world and the community. And we want you to be fully committed to that and being able to like give as much time, love, and energy to that. But we also have business and projects that have to be moved forward and closed. And so to have someone who's empathetic to that dynamic and can find the nuance to it that will help us do it a better way, but also help them, right? And help the young women. And again, like to me, it's also like, if we create that right culture, I think we'll get the most talented women because they'll say, man, they get it. They understand the challenge that we have to go through. And therefore, to have women, I mean, look, I think women obviously provide an immense amount of benefit to businesses. And so to then like limit yourself because you can't figure out some of these challenges because you can't like bring your mind to it. I think we all do ourselves a disservice when we don't think about diversity as being something that's actually an imperative and essential to the process.
No, that's so great. I want to switch gears for a second and jump over to something that, you know, you and I have talked about a little bit in the past. And we've had a couple of recent podcasts where we talked about the unique psychology of being first generation wealth. And I think you've experienced that from a couple of different perspectives. Like you experienced in sort of the more traditional, I went to the NFL and now I got a big contract kind of way that kind of gets romanticized in our community. But you've also experienced in the business side of the way of then how do I go from the NFL and now I'm trying to play a different game. And oh my gosh, I realize it's a whole different sort of wealth. But let's talk a little bit about some of those overnight experiences you've had. And what were some of the unique challenges and possibly the opportunities? We just talked about the opportunities too that come with that. But what are some of the unique challenges, you know, being one of the first people in your family to sort of experience wealth and experience in a relatively rapid way?
One of the challenges is like experience and knowledge, right? There's nothing like having someone who has gone through an experience before you to guide you, right? To be a trailblazer is very challenging because you're carving out the path. And so I try to, as we said, I've always looked at people, you know, around me, ahead of me. So I had teammates from University of Michigan had gone to the NFL before, came from similar economic backgrounds, that we would talk about the nuance of it and like how they dealt with challenges. And like, I actually seen firsthand. I mean, I seen a friend of mine, I was to hang out with Lamar Woodley. I think Lamar probably made up close to $100 million in his NFL career. I've been in a situation where me and Lamar riding in the car with somebody he's friends with. The guy's like, oh, let's stop by the bank. I just got to run to the bank. You know, Lamar, why don't you come in with me? He goes into the bank. The guy has a whole meeting. The bank is shut down. He has a whole meeting with the head of the bank, Lamar, set up to get Lamar to sign like a effectively like a loan document, making himself like, you know, effectively the guarantor of a loan. Mind you, I'm like in college still. I'm seeing this. I'm like, yo, this is crazy. And so I've benefited a lot again from seeing people have, you know, not personally experienced it, but people that I was able to look at and say, okay, I'm going to be there one day. Like, how does this process work? And so, look, personally, I struggled because I cared about my family and I cared about like, you know, their need. And I experienced it. Like I experienced not eating. I experienced like the struggle. And so because of that, I experienced early in the process of like giving money, right? Writing checks. And then I started to learn, man, I gave money the first time. I gave money the second time. I gave money the third time. Nothing is changing. So the process is staying the same without any change in outcome. So I got to change the process. So what I started to realize was, you know, yes, I have resources. Everyone in my family looks to me and says, he's a potential solution for a problem. That's the other thing I realized people start doing. This is something that, like Ross says all the time too. He says, don't solve problems with money, solve them with your mind. But when people think money is easily accessible, they're like, oh, let's just solve it with money. And I started to send it to my family. My new policy becomes, if you are, like, I'm approaching 40, if you're 60s, 70s, 80s in my family, you have a legitimate situation that I can come in and help you with. My grandmother passed away. There was a lawsuit against the hospital. Let me handle the lawyers. I'll pay for the lawyers and make sure we have the right people so this process goes well. So giving them the resources, like not just money, the resources. You guys having an issue. Let me have you guys meet with my accountant so that then, again, trying to give you resources, right? Mm-hmm. That's for all my family. The older ones, I will give you dollars. If you're 50 or below, you still have earning capacity. I will give you lessons. I will give you resources. I'll put you on a call. Like one of my cousins wanted, giving him money. I stopped giving him money. He says, cuz I want to get my trucking license, my CDL license. He went and got a loan, and the loan was like 15%. I said, well, remember I told you, anytime you have getting a loan, talk to me before, because I can help you understand like what loans should be pricing at. I'll pay your loan off, but I'm now your lender. Okay. So you write up a term sheet. You say, what's the term sheet? I said, go and find out what a term sheet is. You Google, find out what a term sheet is. All right, great. That's perfect. I said, okay, now I want you to go and write a promissory note. What's a promissory note? Same thing. Go find out what a promissory note is. And he went through this experience where he learned, what interest rates were, what indexes were, what a spread meant, right? Like he understood like the investment from my perspective into him saying, I'm investing in your future. I believe in you. You got a great trucking business. But he understood what a lender would look at to say, well, if I give you this money, I could actually invest in something else and be making this sort of return. So he started to understand what the index was alluding to and what the spread alluded to. And then again, what a promissory note was and what a term sheet was. And so here's a person who has never come in contact. He didn't finish high school, never come in contact with any kind of real business dynamic outside of his job, right? And maybe signing his mortgage for his home. And now I gave him this experience of learning the process, right? Those are the things I have learned of being kind of that first generation of getting access to wealth is that, like, if you're my age or younger, I want to give you access to knowledge and resources, not dollars. Because the dollars you won't learn from. I want you to learn from the things, right? And if you're older, I want to make sure your life is, in reason as comfortable as possible.
I love that perspective because I feel like so many times, we've talked about this a few times on the podcast, like so many times people come looking for the resource rather than looking for the lesson and not knowing that the lesson is actually far more valuable than the resource. We are almost out of time, but wanted to give you opportunity to close it up. And I just wanted to maybe in sharing some final thoughts and advice for our listeners, you could also touch on this, which is that there's a thread in your story. The headline of your story usually talks about the relationship with Stephen Ross and your time at Related. And it's amazing just what that relationship has meant to you and that he built that relationship. But I heard sort of in your story, there were three other folks. And there were three other folks that shaped your mindset. And it was your mindset that enabled your ability to have a relationship with Stephen Ross and all the other amazing people that you've built. And I heard about your mom. I heard about a professor at Michigan. And I heard today about a colleague that called you and said, this is your moment. This is the time. Are you doing something in a moment when there's a moment? And I'd love for you as you close out and share some final thoughts of advice to talk about the power of those quiet voices that actually shaped your mindset, that set the stage for the front stage that everybody sees.
Yeah.
But there was a behind the scenes, there was a production team, and the production team wired your brain. That was not about how famous somebody was or how much resources they had built. It was about how they thought and that thought process, I believe, is the wiring that shaped Jamar Adams.
That's a tremendous question. I appreciate the opportunity to answer that one, man. That brings me joy to think about that. What I say is this. I've been so blessed to have had two things happen. One, to have my mom, Cecilia Adams, in my life, and it caused me to get emotional thinking about it. And two, actually not having my father when I was growing up. because not having my father around when I was growing up made me posture myself in a position where I sought out strong leadership or strong mentorship, male or female. I was always looking because I felt like I was in a deficit. I had one mother who loved me, but I always felt like I was in a deficit in certain areas. And so I would posture myself to receive from other people the things that I thought I would need in life to get to where I wanted to be, to have the growth and development I wanted. So it didn't matter who you were. It was a pastor. I would posture myself in a manner to receive from them, you know, that character and the values and the dignity, right? My mentor for 100 Black Men, I posture myself and receive from him, you know, the various things. And so what I have realized is that I would encourage everyone to accomplish anything tremendous in life, you will likely need three things, right? You're going to need to have great people around you who are going to be able to advise you. And people have a hard time advising and mentoring people who they think are arrogant, that they think they know it all, who don't walk into the room like, I'm humble. Like, I'm humble. I know things I think I know. But even in that, I'm going to be like, hey, is there any other color I can have to that? I think people who are going to be successful have a tremendous determination because, as I said, starting this business is the hardest thing I've ever done. Running this business is the hardest thing I've ever done because it has called me to become a better me. You cannot lead people. You cannot shepherd people in a business environment where you're dealing with their emotions, their kind of guidance on deals to deals. You get exposure to their family life. Sometimes you're dealing with some of their health issues. You have to be a better person. I have to become a better person to manage my internal team, external teams, and to keep my head on straight of being like, this is the North Star. Stay there, right? Stay right there in North Star. And the final thing I think you need is you are going to need, gonna need a little bit of luck. You're going to need to be able to meet the right people at the right time. And I think that's a divine providence. Like, you will meet the right people at the right time, but you only get there when you're prepared for the meeting. Like, when you've done the work, and it may not seem like you're doing the right work to be prepared for the meeting, but it always seems to work out that you've actually done the right work in the right way at the right time to be ready for that meeting where it's your opportunity. So that then when the guy hits me every day and says, what are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing? There was 10 years that related and 10 years before that, that what had postured me and prepared me to be ready for all the conversations, all the opportunities that were going to be presented to me in 2020 to start Essence and to get it off the ground. And so I just encourage everyone here that, like, and while you're going through your journey in life, always find yourself being postured to be able to receive from other people, right? And then I would say this, the last thing I say, just is my final thought. I think about my life in this way. I'm always trying to find myself at this level. I am a father. Now, I'm a physical father. I have a daughter. I spend time with her. I have to do from a nurturing perspective. I have to be present. There's a whole bunch of things I have to do there. But I have to teach. I have to give my wisdom opportunities to her. So every part of my life, I know I have to be a father. There are people who are looking up to me saying, man, I want to be like Jamar, right? Maybe it's a football dynamic. Maybe it's a business dynamic. Maybe it's something I'm doing in my personal life, the philanthropic things I do. I want to be like Jamar. So I'm a father to people. So I'm a mentor, right? I got to give my time. That's my obligation. But I'm also a son, right? So I'm postured down at the son where there's someone who's mentoring me. There's someone who's giving me wisdom. There's someone who's giving me advice. There's someone who's like, you know, pouring into me, nurturing me at the level I'm at, right? And I have different fathers, just like I have different sons, right? Or daughters, but I'm also a brother, right? And that dynamic, I have to have peers, right? Because sometimes there's conversations that you don't feel as comfortable having with your father. There's some conversations that's not appropriate to have with your sons and daughters, but there's conversations that they'd be had with brothers and sisters, peers of yours, where you can be like, man, and you got to have brothers. And so in life, I think to put yourself in a situation where you're a father or mother, you're giving, you're blessing, you're nurturing, you're mentoring, you're a daughter or son, you're getting that same thing, right? You're receiving the same thing you're doing. And you're also a brother or sister where you have peers that you can like come together and work together on things and work through things that you would not necessarily be able to do that with a father, or it's inappropriate with a son or a daughter.
There you have it. That's Jamar Adams. Stay open to receive in relationships, right? Surround yourself with great people. Bring determination to the table and be prepared for your luck or your divine providence while you hold the posture of a mother or father, of a daughter or son, or of a sister or brother. And I'm very proud to call you a brother of mine, Jamar. Thank you today for sharing with us and being part of it. Until next time, it's the Color Money Podcast.
Follow the Color of Money Podcast today and get notified when new episodes are released weekly.
Be part of this transformative listening experience.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. The views, thoughts, and opinions of the guest represent those of the guest and not Keller Williams Realty LLC and its affiliates, and should not be construed as financial, economic, legal, tax, or other advice. This podcast is provided without any warranty or guarantee of its accuracy, completeness, timeliness, or results from using the information.